Hello, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Transmission Arts on Air. My name is Tanika Tenjin, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Unobserved, an online radio magazine that gathers, selects, and presents some of the best radio and audio from around the world. We believe in the power of great stories, dynamically produced and told, and we have a growing collection of those on theunobserved.com, so please visit. This month on The Unobserved, we're going to present to you with a mixed bag of sorts, let's say a Christmas stocking full of audio. To begin with, we will hear from UK's Dan Wilson, a rogue sound artist who decided to create something specific for The Unobserved. The piece is strange and wonderful and personal, and was our very first piece strictly made for the magazine. It's called EEE by Gum, and we're still trying to figure out what that means. Following that is another piece hailing from the UK. This piece is made by a different sound artist of sorts, a world-renowned DJ who goes by the name Bigga Bush. As a lover of Afrobeat, Bigga Bush has put together this piece, aptly titled Journey into Afrobeat, that highlights the roots and power of this music. Next is a piece by New York-based artist Nina Khachaturian, originally created for Resonance FM in London. The piece is called All Day, Every Day, My Brother Thinks About the Ocean. And it's a very personal piece about Nina's brother, Kai, a professional windsurfer who has long had an obsession with wind. Nina interviews her parents and her brother. The end of this piece is particularly poignant. And finally, we end with a piece that currently touched my heart, Listening to Jamie by UK-based Hugh Levinson. It's about the sounds his son Jamie made in those first few weeks at home, particularly in the middle of the night, where it seems like the rest of the world is asleep. I first heard this piece at the Third Coast International Audio Festival, and having just had a child myself, I find it very touching and true. So on today's edition of The Unobserved on WGXC Transmission Arts, let's begin with Dan Wilson's EEE by Gum. Enjoy.
The unobserved, they're unseen. They just can't be seen. They're unseen for interviews and things, overlooked by the machinery of a capitalist society, trapped in small towns and bullied into conforming with the prevailing waves of mutual misery, but quietly resisting. Coerced into unworldliness. So, for some small escape, they make sounds in desolate marshlands just to shake off the encroaching fungus of frustratingly involuntary idleness. People in the distance can't quite see what's going on across that marshland because it's misty, and the miscomprehension eventually fosters strange hostility. It's a problem. I mean it quite literally. It's an issue and it's depressing. I often wonder what the people I went to university with are doing now. Have they become invisible? I'll always remember one of the tutors confessing that sonic art degrees aren't known for providing an abundance of career prospects. Actually, I don't even want to know what the people I went to university with are doing now. I never talk to them anyway. And also, the other students, they seem to be born into some kind of aristocracy, and the knowledge that they inevitably landed on their feet after graduation would only make me bitter. Classism is rife, despite the government's attempt to stop it. Anyway, to study sound, to really study sound, you have to become a hermit monk. Then you'll find enlightenment. This may come at a price. You may find yourself catapulted into a strange twilight realm, criminally out of phase with the prevailing mood resonance. Any latent awkwardness gets exploded under conditions of unemployment into astronomical wonky. Phases flipped and waveforms clipped. After 3 years of floating, I found that no warehouse, office, bakery, depot, factory, institute, apothecary, store, stable, cafe, library, kitchen, bathhouse, yard, garage, abattoir, conservatoire, laboratory or garden centre will employ me. One particularly gutting remark at the local job centre where I've been signing on since graduation opened my eyes to people's closed ears. After the usual exchange of stilted pleasantries. How's the job search going? Not very well. I've got a degree, but nothing's out there. Nothing seems to be happening. The man suddenly said that Sonic Art is a Mickey Mouse degree, meaning that he considers it to be a subject worthless in what certain stuck-up bastards smugly call the real world. This is particularly offensive. I found it personally offensive, and the comment betrays a real lack of understanding of the most noblest of arts. This phrase Mickey Mouse degree is loaded with political baggage, as it's a term often used to smear those newer college and university courses instated during the Labour government's education drive, which aimed to get more people into study and education, which is a good thing. For some reason, certain people seem to resent the idea of education, so Mickey Mouse implies that an area of study is silly or has no relevance or worth. But it means nothing, it's just a faddish bashing stick that certain people use to bash the government with. All study is good study, isn't it? Well, it increases the mind, doesn't it? Anyway, I told the job centre bloke that he was completely mistaken anyway. The study of sound is actually a fine art, the highest of all subjects, in fact, because it encompasses history, electronics, art, art theory, acoustics, mathematics, music, architecture, geography, geometry, ecology, anthropology, philosophy, psychology, physiology, design, computing, ergonomics, semiotics, cryptography, engineering, physics, metaphysics. More tenuously, it could also be linked to theology, astrology, therapeutics, and medicine, and dancing. After I spewed all this out, and I probably repeated a few of those subjects in my apoplexy at the time, or possibly added a few irrelevant ones like cooking by mistake, he replied, "Well, you're at the job centre now. It hasn't got you very far, has it?" This made me even more furious, so I called him a tosser. He may have some right to be argumentative or dismissive of my discipline, which doesn't seem to have led to anything economically, because it was his taxes that paid for my student loan to undertake the studies in Sonic Art in the first place. I live in abject poverty with my parents, always looking in bins for sustenance. It's a horrible situation, psychically damaging. So not one penny of my student loan has been paid off yet, and it could well never be paid off if no jobs are forthcoming. If that's the case, then my research belongs to the taxpayer, and will always belong to the taxpayer. Therefore, to appreciate such work, the taxpayer must come to understand the nature of sound. And to do that, they need to become open to the creative power of sound, and most of all, their own creative faculties, a kind of revolution in their consciousness. But paradoxically, that the personal revelations that all this involves might propel the taxpayer out of tax payment into the twilight realm. If this happens, a kind of communal church of sound would need to be founded. But all this is just pie in the sky. I'm diverging off topic here. But the point is, an employment advisor is surely employed to get the client happily into a job relevant or resonant to the client's interests and capacities. It seems unbelievable that somebody in a public service should have absolutely no comprehension of the concept of Sonic Art and be so dismissive. So something has to be done, because sound has universal relevance. It's important to humanity. I'll explain that in a minute. There's one more incident that's worth mentioning. A while ago, quite late at night, I was collecting bits of scrap metal from a recycling point, and some rag and bone men arrived in a truck. They came up to me and asked whether or not I was a gypsy. I said no, but they proceeded to say I was one, just because I was looking at the metals. So I just explained that I'm interested in Sonic Art, and I'm looking at the resonant material. But this was fatal. They heard mention of the arts and hurled a lot of abuse at me, some of it tinged with irrelevant racism, something about Polish people, possibly wanting to start a fight, and they accused me of being a practicing sodomite. Obviously, it's a bit weird wandering around scrapyards at midnight, and these are public recycling depots, actually. But all of us on that night were equally as weird. We were all there, me and the rag and bone men. So people often seem repulsed at the mention of Sonic Art. Perhaps it's the art bit that puts them off. from now on, let's call the study of sound and sound creation sonology. I'm a sonoite, and you can be too, anyone can. And this is the important thing. But the strangest thing is, and the most significant thing, is that these hostile people, dismissive of what they call the arts, they're actually in the best possible position to create monumental and impressive sound works. The scrapyard people, those rag and bone men, obviously had a truckload of potential sound sculpture, access to amazing sonic dream objects, electromagnetic door retainers, arc welding equipment, hydraulic and pneumatic utensils, and most essentially, the arcane knowledge of engineering passed down to them through generations. Meanwhile, the job centre advisor is employed in the public sector, so he must be paid quite a lot, so he can afford high-end apparatuses and laptops for quantum sound analysis and synthesis. If he has the imp of the perverse, he can even siphon off numerical data from job centre databases to create artificially generated compositions governed entirely by job market data. I can't see how anyone could deny that that would be interesting. All objects have a sound, a natural resonant frequency that can be sounded by many, many, many different methods of agitation. Blowing, bowing, scraping, insonifying, impulsation, stirring, hydraulic glugging, and all that. Now there exists a wealth of new species of audio forms waiting to be tamed and reared. If music's defined by accepted instrumentation and fixed scales, then it's oblivious to the infinite potential of sound that surrounds us. Vibrating interactions between resonated objects make audible certain tensions between objects, their antipathies and their sympathies. Enlightenment and entertainment for the ear is everywhere, but yet a general unresponsiveness on our part is manifest. Studying sound, and not necessarily studying it under an institution, I'm talking about self-propelled study of sound, has this transformative, sensitivizing effect. Because sound's governed by universal principles, it can dissolve any local, territorial, provincial, classist sensibilities. So I present here the statement E by gum, E-E-E-B-Y-G-U-M, ear enlightenment everywhere, but yet general unresponsiveness manifest. E by Gum seeks to alert people to the power of sound. Sound is the first experience we have of the physical world, vibrations through the mother's womb. So, firstly, people must be compelled to personally explore sound, and this is really difficult, especially in small towns where it's most needed. Subsequently, there may be seeded a quest for further knowledge, researching the academic strands of electroacoustic music of the early and mid-20th century. But experimentation with sound is something that's universal. It's not just restricted to certain institutes that can afford high-end electronic gadgetry. Normal objects have generative properties and processing power. Objects can become resonators, filters, oscillation obstructors, depending on the qualities of the object. Objects can be found everywhere, in bins, scrapyards, and shops. This sonology, the study of sound, doesn't involve just what we can hear, it can be motion too. For instance, the earth oscillates between light and dark on a 24-hour cycle, which makes stuff happen. Sound makes stuff happen, and that can be seen in Hans Jenny's cymatics. Matter is organized into wondrous patterns when subjected to resonant frequencies. Earth oscillates, plants grow, land is shaped, animals and humans are resonated on this 24-hour cycle, and all our behaviour and activities are shaped by, or even a direct result of, this planetary spin frequency. Ideas are resonances too, like sound. I don't want to get too metaphysical, but anyone can see how concepts resonate through minds. So the one concept that's most important, sonology, the practice and study of sound, E by gum, seems also to be one of the least resonant, like a quiet thud, which is unfortunate. In my experience, inspiring or provoking any reaction from people with talk of sound is fruitless. Perhaps I've got a boring voice. Where are people's exploratory instincts? Have they been stifled by something? And what is laziness? Surely inertness can be transformed into action by resonance at the resonant frequency of enthusiasm. What's needed is a resonant idea carrier wave to modulate sonology onto. This might get people at least appreciative of the seemingly infinite possibilities of sound. Unfortunately, I don't know what this key carrier wave idea might be. The only solution is to improvise, make as many different noises as possible in different places at different times, and judge the responses. Hopefully, we'll soon be able to discuss our sound-making activities with anybody on the street and exchange knowledge
and insight. E by gum. E by gum.
Thank you for listening to The Unobserved on WGXC Transmission Arts. The piece you just heard was by Dan Wilson and was titled E by Gum. Now we have Bigga Bush's Journey into Afrobeat.
This is a journey into
Afrobeat. 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 Afrobeat.
This is Bigga Bush, aka Lightning Head.
Lightning Head, come again!
This is the story of how I stumbled upon a new style of music. A style I'd never heard before, but which seemed to bring together virtually everything I loved about music of black origin. That became an obsession, eventually leading to the creation of a whole album, 13 Faces of Lightning Head. A story of how this led to this. While this somehow mutated into this. With a hefty dose of this, heavily influencing this. But first we need to go back, way back, to the year 2000. After nearly 10 years, I'd finally quit Rockers Hi-Fi.
He can push, 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 push the tempest by.
I was pursuing a solo career as
Mr. Bigga Bush. You know what I'm saying?
I was doing remixes for people like Ella Fitzgerald. Manuel Gass. Ennio Morricone. Richard Dorfmeister's Tosca. And the late, great Serbian artist who lived, worked, and sadly died in Brazil, Suba. At this point, I'd never actually heard the music of Fela Kuti. But I was about to get an introduction to the powerhouse behind Afrobeat, to the rhythms and sounds of Mr. Tony Allen, drummer with the Africa 70, for 11 years, Fela's right-hand man. Early in 2000, I was asked to produce a brand new track using original drum parts recorded by Tony Allen. A dream come true for any beathead producer such as myself. I received a CD of Tony in the studio, playing an amazing Afrobeat rhythm. Complex yet simple, tight yet somehow loose, with all four of his limbs apparently playing independently of each other. All I knew about Afrobeat, or Fela Kuti at this point, was that he had a massive band that used to play all-night gigs at a club called The Shrine in Lagos, Nigeria. I imagined them having a huge horn section, maybe 20 or 30 saxophones and trumpets lined up along the stage, with maybe 10 or more women dancing and gyrating in front, and with Fela directing. The task I'd set myself was to somehow recreate a form of music I'd never actually heard. This is the result. Drumfire by the Elenco Brotherhood Ensemble. Really strange to me now, looking back, was that although I loved working on this track, I never once thought about checking out any more of Fela's music, or even Tony Allen's music. Not till much, much later. Fast forward 4 years to 2004. Standing at a party in a field, enjoying the swaying of a million ears of corn, when I notice a particular tune being played by the DJ. It's funk, but unlike any funk I've heard before. The horns are somehow bigger and brasher, the beats are slightly off-kilter, but it's driving and raw. I have to find out who this tune is by. Super Afro Beat by the Daktaris on Daptone Records. I don't know anything about them, but I have to find this record. I became quite obsessed with finding more of the same. And this was to set the tone for my next project. By 2004, I had been vaguely thinking about doing a follow-up to Studio Don, the first Lightning Head album, released in 2002, which took reggae and dub ideas and attempted to cross-pollinate them with elements of Cuban and New Yorican sounds, throwing in some Brazilian beats for good measure.
Studio Don 1, what do I think of LED sound? LED song, that is Lightning Head song. That is a dangerous song. LED song is Lightning Head song.
Studio Don was a party record. A record that was supposed to sound like it was laid down by a house band over an afternoon and an evening. somewhere on a mythical island between Kingston and Havana. There was a clue in the lyrics I'd written, ham-fistedly parodying the Chemical Brothers sample. It began in Africa. It began in a freakout. Of course, it began in Africa. All the music I loved, reggae, samba, funk, soul, ultimately went back to Africa. And yet I'd somehow miss this glaringly self-evident fact. When I thought of African music, I thought of Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, the Bundu Boys, Youssou N'Dour, all great artists, but none of them particularly rocking my world. Gradually, I became aware of a whole other area of African music, until quite recently, pretty much unknown in the West. I remembered an article I'd read about a guy called Duncan Brooker, who'd been working in Nairobi for the Kenyan news agency Camera Picks. After the job finished, he found himself footloosed in East Africa, with time on his hands to indulge his passion for finding lost funk treasures. Records being a rare commodity in Africa anyway, Brooker's quest was made all the harder by the terrible state of repair of many of the plates he found, warping and melting in dusty old boxes on market stalls, sometimes covered with mud, or virtually worn out by years of play on an ancient turntable whose stylus had never been replaced. Being a vinyl junkie, Duncan Brooker persisted, and 7 years later, he returned to London with hundreds of rare African singles and albums he'd found in shops, hotel wardrobes, bicycle repair places, and under people's beds, to found the label Kona Records. He only ever released one volume of this extraordinary Afro-rock music, but I was lucky enough to find a copy and know I was on the right track.
Donc, music Afro. Nandenge biso zali ba Africain, ibongi kobetaka ba music Afrika. Ko biso zali bana Afrika. Yango wana usaile bino. Première présentation, ya l'orchestre Afro Zaï, ya Afro music.
Ya solo. C'est la vérité.
My next port of call was Soundway Records, run by Miles Claret in Brighton, England. Hey! I'd sent him a copy of Studio Don. He liked it. We swapped a few emails. But I still hadn't heard anything on his label, Soundway, which concentrated on music from West Africa in the mid-70s. Rare Afrobeat, Afro-funk, Afro-fusion, most of which had never been released outside of Africa. Some of it, nowhere in the world. A visit to Brighton led to a meeting at his house, where he played me a whole heap of amazing, funky, fresh, raw 7-inches on a shot-to-pieces sound system as I frantically scribbled notes, trying to visually record elements of the music on paper so that I could revisit them later. I didn't know if I was ever going to hear these tunes again, or even whether Miles would eventually release any of them, despite the fact that he'd laboriously sourced them on many visits to West Africa. What I did know was that I wanted to be able to recreate some of the energy, the feel, and above all, the funk of these tunes. One tune that particularly grabbed me was by the Nigerian Police Force Band. It had a loping groove, a scratchy 2-3 clave line on guitar, and a bass line that borrowed heavily from Dave and Ansel Collins' skinhead classic, Double Barrel.
I am W-O-O-O, and I'm still here again.
elements were easy enough to notate, and once I got back into the studio, I began to assemble the piece that became the Nigerian Police Groove, opening track on the LP. Were a lot harder to recall from memory, but I was fortunate enough to be working with an excellent drummer, Ralph Cree, who also had a passion for Afrobeat. He taught himself to play like Tony Allen and was happy to lay down some rhythm patterns which became the basis of many of the drum parts on the album. Another fascinating track that Miles Claret played me was a record by the Don Isaac Ezekiel combination, Amalinja. The bass line seemed to underpin the music without ever actually repeating itself. And later I discovered that in a lot of African music, the bass is regarded as a melody instrument, not part of the rhythm section at all. Ever since Rockers Hi-Fi, I've been working on ways to make the bass as heavy as possible, dub style. Inspired by the DIE combination, I experimented with a crazy bass line, programmed to keep reinventing and varying itself. And this is what you hear on Area Boy. So here we are in 2008 and the album's finished. Ironically, some of those unreleased tunes came out just after I completed it, on Soundway's Nigeria Special compilations. So I was finally able to hear the tunes I'd spent months reimagining in my own studio. Kinda glad I wasn't able to listen to them while I was making my own record. Far better to have a memory, an impression on which to let one's creativity run riot, embroider, twist, and manipulate into something new. I didn't set out to make an Afrobeat record, rather to allow elements of a particular era in music to set some of my musical parameters. Not to indiscriminately copy ideas, but to build on them, sometimes half-remembered, sometimes misremembered, to make something new. This, I hope, is what you can hear on 13 Faces of Lightning Head. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. produced by Bigger Bush and out on Lionhead Recordings. Available on CD, LP and MP3 from biggerbush.co.uk and all discerning record shops.
You were just listening to Journey into Afrobeat by UK-based DJ Bigger Bush. Now, artist Nina Khachaturian's All Day, Every Day. My brother thinks about the ocean.
When my brother Kai was 15, he convinced my parents to let him move from our home in California to Maui for a semester of high school. He had gotten very serious about windsurfing. Kai's type of windsurfing involves riding huge waves in very strong wind, a combination that only a few places in the world have, and Maui is one of them. Maui became his home, and now, at age 38, he's sort of an elder statesman of the sport. For the past 12 years, I've lived in Brooklyn, pursuing a career as a visual artist. My mother is a literary translator, and my father is a human biology professor. My parents and I may not do the same thing, but we do have some context for what each one of us does. But Kai does something that very few people will ever be able to understand from the inside. We've never tried to discuss this gap in understanding, so this radio piece became my excuse for a set of conversations about it. I talked with my parents in person, and then a few months later I got my brother on the phone while he was in California en route to Maui. The ocean is Kai's obsession, his livelihood, the place that shapes his physical and philosophical existence, and all day, every day, my brother thinks about the ocean. So I was trying to remember when he started windsurfing, and you guys had discovered on the phone bill there was a huge number of charges to...
Oh, yeah, there was a number you could call to find out what the wind was doing on the coast, so that involved a out-of-town telephone call.
I used to think that initially he just needed to know about wind conditions because of sailing. But then he just also needs to know the wind condition, even if he's not sailing. He just... like he needs to be constantly present at the ocean, and by knowing the wind conditions and so on, it sort of as if transports him there. His universe is filled with this wind.
What does it feel like to be on one of these huge waves with that much wind? And I remember you told a story once that I've never forgotten, which was that, you know, when a wave is really, really huge, you said you can scream and not hear yourself when you're on it. Right,
well,
like it's that loud.
That was at Jaws on a 20-foot Hawaiian wave where, you know, it wasn't me on the wave. I was outrunning the thing and it had broken top to bottom behind me. And at the moment the lip hits the water from breaking top to bottom, that's when I screamed.
Right.
So trust me, I mean, yeah, it rattles your bones. It's pure detonation.
God. That's the thing I'm interested in you trying to describe. Like, you know, like someone like me who's never done this, like, what does it feel like? Just walk me through, like, one amazing ride, like, from beginning to end. Like, what does it feel like?
Piahi, or Jaws, is one of the heaviest waves in the world. Basically, you're on the outside, and you're in huge ground swells, and you look towards where the waves are breaking. All you see are these large backs.
Man.
Huge plumes of spray shooting up for them. You know, the plumes that get shot up in the air from the wave of that size dwarf the wave itself. I mean, you're looking, when you look at the whole picture of all this spray that gets thrown in the air, it's 100, 200 feet.
Wow.
Like, I mean, the 100-foot wave is out there.
You know, what he reminds me of is that I read some years ago that the two things that great military commanders have in common, the one most important thing they have in common, and that is Alexander the Great, Napoleon, is that they will look at a battlefield and they will correctly anticipate what the enemy is going to do. And so they position their troops accordingly.
Jaws, basically, you know, selection. You're looking at some factors. Okay, you're on the outside now. You need to play your game right. You need to make your decision. What wave are you going on? Are you going to get the right one? What's behind it? So it's ground swelling. And then it hits the ledge, and the whole wave slows down and grows and grows and grows. What you see when you're, I'm looking at like my friend dropping in on a wave when I'm sailing out of the channel, it makes the guy look like he's shrinking. It is loading up all this water that is coming unintended from the open North Pacific, and it is loading it up on an outside reef in perfect symmetry, too, by the way, because they're going to drop out of place on it. It's just out of scale. You're dropping in, and you feel the moment you're either in or you're not. And that's the scary part. Jaws, you're like, okay, it's the simple things that become big tasks, like making the drop, making the bottom turn. You know, you're really kind of like you're doing things with a note of caution. It's such a powerful wave that there's no question in your mind mentally that you're just, you know, you're visiting, you're not in control. You are at the mercy of the ocean.
The military metaphor, I think, is very apt, but he is not thinking of himself as being out there battling these waves.
Yeah.
He's thinking of it more, and he has, you know, expressed this actually, more as almost like a ballet, like a dance,
huh.
like you're one with the elements, like you
collaborating.
You
can't fight. You can't fight
it.
Right.
You have to. So it's in a sense, it's kind of a mystical space.
Do you have in your mind or in your experience the most memorable bad day and the most memorable great day? You know, examples of like the best it got and the worst it got for you?
It's funny how they can both be the same day. I mean, yeah, my first day I ever sailed Jaws, I almost had a 2-wave hold down.
You were held under for 2 waves.
I got held down for 2 waves in a row. You know, I was down for over 20, I was down for about 25 seconds off 1 wave.
Ugh.
And when I was coming up for air, I heard the second wave break. Okay, so what do I hear when I'm getting drilled by, you know, a solid 18-foot Hawaiian with a 30-foot base again, maybe a little bigger, and I'd gotten caught from behind on it. You know, I remember getting to the point where I'm not quite, you know, 100% relaxed, but I'm like, air is going to be cool. And you hear that underwater.
What do you hear?
Not from the wave that's working you, but a new, like, basically a wave's working you. And it subsides, but you're still getting ragdolled underwater. Okay, it subsides. And then as you're coming up, you hear the distance and coming closer, like a freight train on the tracks coming closer to you, sort of. So there you have it. That's setting up for the 2-wave hold down. I'm like telling myself, that's the next wave breaking. Should I come up for air or not? Okay, and that's after, you know, 25 seconds. I can hold my breath for well over a minute, 15. So I got that for me.
Right.
And so I was like, came up for air. Right as I got, you know, got to the surface, first of all, there's a lot of foam and mm-hmm. surf that size, like foam the size of your arm. You got to clear the water to get your breath. And then you do that, and you, you know, get your breath. And then, you know, that white water that broke, it was already broken away, full white water turning, was right in my face. So, I mean, the second wave worked me worse than the first wave. Considerably worse, actually. And I got absolutely drilled by the second one. I took that wave on the surface. Dude, it's nasty when I remember it.
When you're inside that wave, the second one you described, what are you doing actually physically? Are you trying to swim? Are you in a ball? Are you like, what are you doing?
There's certain things you can do that are going to keep you on the surface. One of them is you can't fight anything.
Mm-hmm.
You really just go limp. You go limp for two reasons. You go limp, but you hold yourself strong. I mean, yeah, I've done a little curled in a ball thing. Sometimes when you curl in a ball, it allows the wave to drag you deeper, though. And that's never all that great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, usually it's kind of a combination of kind of you get your arms spread open, you anchor yourself kind of. You can do this little anchor thing.
Right.
Where if you can get pushed down, under, and through, that's one thing.
When there is wind, when he's sailing,
he's like
he can't
possessed.
It's like,
yeah, I know.
And it's like
possessed.
An addiction.
Yeah,
and it's
sure.
never enough. Like, he may sail, you know, 6 hours a day.
Right.
And the following day, if there is wind, he can't say, you know,
yeah,
I sailed
no.
6 hours yesterday. It's that day. Every day
yeah.
is a precious
right.
opportunity.
Right.
If there is something to be squeezed out of that moment,
right.
that takes priority over
everything else.
And
yeah.
everything
yeah.
else.
See, the other thing I think about the particular sport he does, and it's true for a few other sports too, of course, but you never have the same thing twice. It's
no.
never the same wave.
That's right.
It's never the same wind. And so,
right.
you know, I was thinking about the trip that he did. This was actually a surfing trip, but the trip that he did to G-Land in
yes.
Indonesia. And he came back with this, like, crappy picture that he took in the disposable camera he had with him of this distant wave. You couldn't even see the thing.
Yeah. No,
and he stared at that picture, and it had, you know,
yes.
It was like 30 iterations of that picture. So that was, the whole roll was that wave.
Well, I picked him up
at a great distance.
Yeah, a great distance.
I picked him up at the airport and from that G-Land trip. And the entire trip from the airport, he spoke nonstop.
Yeah.
About this experience of getting up, you know, at sunrise. And I just listened and listened, and finally I told myself, you know, the only way I can understand this is that if I collect things, rugs and art and whatever, this guy collects experiences.
Right.
He's not interested in possessions. I imagine the inside of his head is like this weather reporting maps. Constantly there is a weather map where, you know, winds are flowing, clouds are coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's his kind of interior world.
So Kai, you're not just watching the weather locally, you're watching the weather all around the world, depending on where you might be going.
I mean, really, you know, if I was granted, you know, free rein and had my own Gulfstream 5, I could tell you right now, unequivocally, that I would be going places all the time. I would be following hotspots. Like right now, you want to watch the Indian Ocean, it's amazing. Oh my God. There's a reason the surf's really super good in Indonesia. It's the Indian Ocean.
Okay, wait. I have a game. I have an idea. Let's say you do have the private jet and you have 2 weeks and you're going to try to hit, say, three spots at their most optimum.
Now, where would I go? Gosh, I mean, you know, kid in a candy store right now, I'd say, like, if you said it was right now for the next 2 weeks, where would I go?
Yeah, let's say that.
I would wrap the show up here. I'd be on it here. I would be here, Tahiti and Indo. I might even go as far as to say here, Western Australia, Indo.
Okay.
Because I'm tapping two different sources there. The South Pacific kind of doesn't train into the Indian Ocean. What happens is some of these storm balls, they'll frickin' fire swell from Cape Town to Madagascar to India to Indonesia to Western Australia, go under Australia, slam New Zealand, open ocean storm at that point. I swear to you, I've tracked storms before that started off the tip of South Africa, did what I just described, went under Australia, sent a 3 to 4 day swell to us here in California with all the Southern Pacific Islands in between, Hawaii, went under South America and went back to frickin' Africa, and the whole did set swelled one storm, regrouped and regenerated, and went around the entire southern hemisphere.
Wow, that's amazing.
I've seen it happen before.
One of the most profound things this boy has ever told me, we were on the phone once, and he was a teenager, and he was on Maui, and there was something that we were, you know, having a disagreement about. And we were talking about this and not getting anywhere. And he said to me on the phone, he said, "Dad, there is no point carrying on this conversation because I am all id, you are all super ego, and we don't have an ego between us."
You could have paid for a lot of therapy.
He was absolutely right. He is all id, I am all super ego, yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have an ego between us. I told him once, I said, "I have known many people, and I am one of them, who pretty much have done what they wanted to do. But all of us have also done a lot of things that we didn't want to do. You know, you do what you want, you also shovel a lot of manure in the process." He is the only person I know who would do what he wants to do and would not do what he doesn't want to do, more or less. And I have never made up my mind whether his way of living, which is, you know, doing exactly what you want to do, paying the price, whatever it is, and having a passion. I have never had a passion.
Mm.
That's why my life has always been kind of on an even keel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have done things that I have very much enjoyed, but it's kind of an Aristotelian mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas people like him, we live for something.
That was Nina Khachaturian's All Day, Every Day, My Brother Thinks About the Ocean. And today we end the show with BBC's Hugh Levinson's Listening to Jamie, about precisely that, the late night noises of his then newborn.
On a winter's night in London, the darkness seems to go on and on. The sun vanishes before 4 in the afternoon, and it's gone until after 9 the next morning. You can almost hear the hiss of the blackness.
The frost performs its secret ministry, unhelped by any wind.
At 2:45 a.m. on a dark night, 13th of November, Jamie arrived, our firstborn.
At my side, my cradled infant slumbers peacefully.
Alison and I had expected an explosion of sounds. Crying, lullabies, toys, coughing, wailing, cooing grannies. All the noises you'd expect around a newborn.
Well, I'll read that first bit then. And then, yeah, I wrote this on the 20th of November, which is a week. He was 1 week old. I could cry and cry to think you're finally here on the outside, not the inside. Little movements you make remind me of movements you made inside me. The little bottom in the air, the spasm of the fingers and the hands, the look of careful concentration on your face when faced with a new experience, a trip in the sling or in the pram.
But at least we thought, during those short periods when he was asleep, things would quieten down.
Now, I don't know why I wrote this. He doesn't tap dance, does he? No, 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 he'll be no trouble.
Tis calm indeed, so calm that it disturbs and vexes meditation with its strange and extreme silentness.
That's normal. That's what Samuel Taylor Coleridge says in Frost at Midnight. But we were wrong, and so was he. As Jamie went to sleep, the audio show started. He was as noisy asleep as awake. Well, almost. Do you remember what the nights were like? Because it was so dark, because it was winter.
Yeah. It was sort of punctuated by by these percussive sort of noises, and it sort of, he'd hammer a little hole in the peaceful night, wouldn't he?
What could I do but dig out my mini-disc machine and hang the mic over the side of the cot, to Alison's amused disgust? As the night wore on, Jamie put on a carnival of sound. Some human, some animal, some industrial. Snuffles, wheezes, snorts, mini-snorts, grunts, mini-grunts, trombone, steam whistle, air escaping from pistons, steam brake, industrial press, depth charge, fingernails on a blackboard, backwards guitar, rim shot, dolphin clicks, seal, hosa, baby elephant, lost baby elephant,
dear babe that sleeps cradled by my side,
piglet,
whose gentle breathings heard in this deep calm.
Piglet rooting for acorns.
Fill up the indispersed vacancies.
Piglet getting desperate.
The momentary pauses of the thought.
Here's a synopsis for a story that's never been written. The female character is extremely pissed off at the good suggestions from her partner on getting the baby to sleep, which always work. It ends horribly.
What were you up to, Jamie? What distant lands were you visiting in your sleep? I know that when we dream, we process everything we've seen and heard during the day. And newborn babies are hearing a lot for the first time. All those muffled sound waves they felt in the womb are now bombarding them loud and clear. So are your snorts and grunts the sound of your dreams.
the 29th of December. Jamie in the crook of Hugh's arm, upright, belly to belly, as Hugh rocks in the nursing chair. Such a tiny, perfect little head, skin like the paper you get in Bibles, smooth like an oil painting. Not just the perfection of the fresh skin, the perfection of trust. All our values topsy-turvy, this tiny man is king, his dependence a revelation and a privilege.
All seasons shall be sweet to thee, whether the eavesdrops fall, heard only in the trances of the blast, or if the secret ministry of frost shall hang them up in silent icicles, quietly shining to the quiet moon.
As the winter turned to spring, then to summer, as the darkness retreated and the light and warmth seeped into our bedroom, your snuffles and hoots gradually receded. We got more sleep, but still I missed your bizarre nightly sound show. Of course, you hadn't exactly fallen silent. Your journey to the limits of human vocalization had just moved into the light. The sounds you're making in your waking hours were becoming just as varied and colorful, and the volume knob was way up.
Well, it's July, and we're on holiday in northern Spain, and we've just discovered this abandoned church up a gravel path, and there's plaster peeling off the walls, and it's quite dark in here, and there are bats in what we think is the vestry. But one of the things about being here is that Jamie has discovered echoes.
So there you have it, a variety of pieces from The Unobserved. My name is Tanika Tenjian, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Unobserved, an online radio magazine that gathers, selects, and presents some of the best radio and audio from around the world. If you'd like to learn more about The Unobserved, learn more about whom you heard today, explore other pieces there, or receive the magazine, please visit theunobserved.com. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Transmission Arts on Air.